Hello and welcome to Research VR Podcast, episode number 14, where we dig deep into the research of virtual reality through the lenses of cognitive science. Today, I'm your host, Oz Balabanian, Program Manager and Scientific Contributor at Upload VR, joined by Peter Lekoff, a VR engineer and networker at Salt and Pepper Software Solutions.
Hi.
And Christoph Izdebski, a VR UX researcher at Salt and Pepper as well.
Hello.
In today's episode, we're leveraging VR for sports medicine and injury prevention with our special guest, Dr. Adam Kiefer.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And in fact, Adam Kiefer is a director of training, enhancement, and analysis of movement virtual reality laboratory in the Division of Sports Medicine and Cincinnati Children's Hospital. He is as well an assistant professor at the Department of Pediatrics, College of Medicine, and member of the Center of Cognition, Action, and Perception at the University of Cincinnati. Hi, once again.
I'm excited to be here.
Yay. So, before we go into this rather new format for us, where we will have a sort of panel discussion with all of us together, I would love you, Adam, to introduce yourself a little bit. So where did you study and how did you end up where you are now?
Sure. So I began my studies with a bachelor's in exercise and movement science at the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse. And while I was there, I started actually as a computer science major and kind of got pulled into more of the movement science work, but still always had a love for technology and computers and that sort of thing. So as I moved on in my studies and ended up in Florida getting my master's in movement science, I started moving into kind of a sports psychology area and utilizing research technologies for electrophysiological data collections and things like that. I then went on to the University of Cincinnati and got my PhD in experimental psychology, where we continued to use technology, advancements in motion capture technology, and again, more electrophysiological data collection methods to look at human behavior, particularly human perception and action behavior. My postdoc then was at Brown University, and that's where I first got my taste of virtual reality. I was in the virtual environment for navigation laboratory at Brown University under the direction of Bill Warren, and it was a really large free ambulatory virtual reality lab that allowed us to do a lot of really interesting research around virtual reality and motor behavior. Some of the other students were doing it on spatial navigation and that sort of thing. But I really got to enjoy it. We had a couple of grants there that were funding research looking at patients with visual deficits, such as hemianopia, where they were losing one part of the visual field, retinitis pigmentosa, almost like tunnel vision. And we were using VR to see how these individuals were able to navigate complex and cluttered environments. And the nice thing about VR, of course, is that the virtual obstacles don't hurt you when you run into them. So it was nice being able to put these patients in these environments and letting and kind of seeing how they were able to navigate around these stationary and moving obstacles while still not really interfering with patient quality of life.
And that's quite impressive.
Yeah, it was really a lot of fun. And like I said, that's where I really started to get into virtual reality. And we started trying to take, we had a tethered system at that time with long 75 or 100 foot VGA cables and power cables going to a backpack that a cord wrangler had to wear. And they had to wrangle the cords while the user was in about a $50,000 Rockwell Collins head-mounted display. And that's okay. where it was in 2009 when I started. By 2012, as I was kind of finishing up my postdoc, we had moved to a wireless solution with that same head-mounted display. But we still hadn't gotten rid of all of the backpack because of a lot of the battery weight and things like that that were still powering. I mean, that HMD was a pretty large piece of equipment. So when I interviewed at Cincinnati Children's, one of the things they were interested in was starting to advance their own injury prevention research by leveraging new technologies. And so it just so happened that I was talking with one of the researchers and discussing kind of my goals for VR long term, and it really kind of caught his eye, and he wanted to start taking advantage of some of the advances in technology. And as I started at Children's then, it kind of coincided with this new virtual reality boom that we're having. And we started looking at more portable VR solutions where we could utilize the wireless technologies that we had going at my postdoc lab and could implement it with our own kind of custom hardware here to start creating sport-specific virtual reality scenarios for our athletes. Correct. Yeah, there are actually no cables attached to the individual at all.
What kind of a HMD are you using then? Is this some kind of a proprietary thing you guys built?
It is. It is. We actually went down the path. We started with the Oculus Rift DK1, which allowed similar wireless capabilities. Of course, it had a lower resolution than a lot of the HMDs that are being released at the consumer level today. As they released the DK2, of course, the DK1 became hard to get our hands on. And so when we purchased the DK2, I actually purchased two of them and realized that whatever modifications they had made between DK1 to DK2, it no longer allowed us to utilize these consumer-grade wireless HD transmitters and receivers. So then I started down the path of exploring all of these different companies. And of course, even up to a year ago, a lot of these things were still in developer modes and they were really hard to get your hands on. Some of them you had to send in an application to even get access to. And we just kind of got tired of waiting on companies whose goal wasn't even kind of what we were doing, but was, you know, to get into the masses. And so because of that, we just decided, well, maybe we've got some in-house folks here who could at least give us a hand. And it just so happened one of our clinical engineers was really interested in virtual reality. But of course, at the hospital, most of the things he's working on are not so much human behavior as they are more like lab bench work. So he really got behind this and got excited about it. And yeah, we custom built our own head-mounted display where we kind of started with a backpack setup where the user would have to wear a backpack so we could hold all of the batteries and the receiver and that sort of thing. And that was kind of our first prototype. And I would say the second prototype, we made a huge leap where now we just have a small, maybe 1-inch by 2-inch box on the back of the HMD strap that would sit kind of on the occipital process.
And is it right that you are actually use the OS VR design from Razer? Yeah.
So that was kind of our initial to get a quick and dirty HMD prototype for the screen and everything and kind of the casing. That's exactly what we did. We didn't want to reinvent the wheel. There's been a lot of smart people that have been working on this for a long time. And and so that's kind of where we started. We were on a time crunch with a couple of data collection deadlines. So we were kind of on a blitz where we threw this all together in about 7 or 8 months. And now we're just starting to meet with some design folks here in-house to kind of redesign the casing to make it a little bit more stable on the head and those sorts of things. But yep, we definitely couldn't have done it without a lot of that planning done by Razer and OSVR for sure.
And the tracking is actually done via the Vicon, right? Sensors?
Via motion analysis.
Okay.
But it's the same idea. So it's just passive reflective markers that are stuck onto the body, generally right to the skin via adhesive. And we put on, I mean, anywhere from 30 to 40 markers on an individual. It depends on how much data we want to collect because there's kind of two streams of data, right? There's the stream of data that goes into for instance, Unity, which is the software that we're currently using, that drives the avatar of the user in the virtual space. And then there's also the data stream that's the biomechanics that we're interested in actually measuring. So in order to drive the avatar, we don't need all that many markers, but in order to get kind of research grade data and joint biomechanics, we do need to go up to the 30 or 40 markers.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any plans to actually, you know, build it for other labs too?
Yes, like, actually,
at some point.
That was kind of the other impetus for doing this was I have a lot of colleagues, you know, some that I had worked as a postdoc with at Brown and some that I've just gotten to know over the last several years. And we were all hitting this wall. And in fact, they had done a lot of the legwork trying to figure out a wireless solution for some of the new HMDs. So they saved me a lot of time because I just called them and they said, you know, we've been working on this for 8 or 9 months. We can't figure it out. I've had some of my best students trying to figure this out. And so once we kind of got our working prototype, I've already been in touch with a lot of them about, you know, selling this to them at cost for research purposes, just so we can kind of start spreading VR through all these labs and utilizing all of the new technologies that are quickly advancing for us.
And that's a very good point. When we consider that, let's say, exactly what you have been told like a few minutes ago, that Oculus doesn't care about the scientific use of their devices. They want to hit the mass market, right? And the other big companies like HTC and Sony also really, you know, don't care about the few devices they could sell into this, they could actually sell into the science. But if the scientists like you, you know, start to develop their own prototypes and start to distribute them, that's kind of a really grassroots approach, you know, to enable science to have great VR equipment while being maybe a little bit less dependent on the big hardware manufacturers, right?
Absolutely. And of course, I don't think any of us fault them for taking that approach. That's the smart approach for any business. But we do have different goals, you know, in research, yeah. we don't necessarily have to make money immediately. So we can afford to take the time to tweak our hardware to make it cost effective and usable and customize it in ways that, you know, consumer grade products don't need to be made. For instance, we need a lighter weight head mount display that's going to be more durable because we're dealing with sports. And if you're starting to get into kind of some free ambulatory things, those are a lot of different questions than being tethered to a PC and playing playing games or developing in these virtual environments. Like I've seen some of these art virtual environments and things like that. You know, those are very different user experiences. So I would say that even our custom-built HMD probably has a pretty narrow niche and really is just for high-movement, high-impact, dynamic virtual environments.
So what kind of trade-offs did you guys have to make in terms of developing this HMD? Are you guys essentially bringing down the resolution to an acceptable amount but keeping the latency really, really low because it is all about the movement that you guys are building? And as a follow-up, what is your wireless solution? Because I haven't heard of too many people being able to do wireless HMDs yet, except for one of them called Nitero, who's doing kind of this 60 gigahertz, low latency, high bandwidth solution. But yeah, how did you guys solve this issue that seems like every HMD manufacturer is trying to solve?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Actually, there is a lab manager at Brown. I want to make sure I give him credit, Michael Fitzgerald, who is doing a lot of this work, getting us off of that long cable up in the Venn lab. And he was using the Nereus Ares Pro, which is just a consumer-grade HDMI transmitter and receiver. And it's usually used for HDTVs so that you don't have to have cables hanging out when you have a TV, you know, wall-mounted.
And but so what's the latency?
The latency, you know, I don't even have those specs. I know it is listed on their site. So
what's the company code again?
Nereus.
Nereus, okay. Because for virtual reality, this latency factor is like super important, right? And even though you can get those wireless transmission full HD and even 4K signals, they obviously use compression. Compression costs you a lot of time.
Absolutely. And I do know that when we latency tested it, and again, Michael was doing all of this testing, he tested the latency for the cables versus the latency for the wireless transmitter. And our latency for our cables generally were under 40 milliseconds. And we could get even faster depending on also our positional data streams. With the Nereus, we were far below that. I think it was even sub 10 milliseconds when he was
benchmarking. That's impressive.
And again, this is just consumer grade technology. We didn't do anything to this. It was just out of the box, plug it in, and then provide, you know, portable power supplies for the receiver and for the head mounted display.
Does it support, I mean, occlusion, right? So if you turn, if the participant turns 180 degrees around where the receiver isn't exactly, you know, looking at the transmitter, you know, how big is that range, or can you bend over and it'll still work?
Yeah, so that's actually getting back to your question about what kind of compromises did we have to make. So obviously line of sight is a big issue in this market for a lot of the higher fidelity, higher resolution transmitters and receivers. And so the nice thing about the Nereus Pro is that you don't need direct line of sight. And in fact, that particular transmitter receiver can, if you have line of sight, it can go, they claim up to about 110 feet, I believe. Maybe even a little bit more. I can tell you our lab is about 60 feet long, and we can go all the way end to end, and we don't have any change in latency or dropout. If we're going through walls, I've gone up to 30 feet and I've had no issues, but I haven't pushed it much beyond that.
That's fascinating of what you guys are doing. I think we should start talking about the, a little bit of the research that you actually are using this technology to facilitate with. Because, I mean, obviously this is really interesting, and I think everyone is still looking to get rid of that umbilical cord that we're all attached to. But what you're doing with this, I think, is even more interesting than the tech that you guys have put together.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I mean, the hardware has been really fun, and in some ways it's been exciting because we're trying to, we're not that we're competing with the big boys, but we're definitely running the same race. We're kind of the novice runner in the marathon. But it's been a lot of fun kind of innovating with my small team and taking all of their ideas and kind of putting it into a finished product. But you're right, the virtual environments are really where the bread and butter is. And that's where we started with kind of what I consider low-hanging in terms of the ease of doing some of this. And it may not seem low-hanging, but for some of the things that we want to do, just setting up a sport-specific scenario where we can put an athlete in a virtual on a virtual field or in a virtual stadium, and they can perform a practice-like maneuver. For instance, we have them, some high school girls right now, we just finished data collection where they were performing a virtual header on a soccer corner kick or football for those of you in Europe. And they were basically just assessing their jump and landing as they're heading that virtual ball. And normally in biomechanics research and sports medicine, we would look at their jump landing skills by putting them on a box, and it's called a drop vertical jump. It's one of the most well-studied maneuvers in biomechanics. You just have them drop off of the box on both feet, land, and then jump up as if they're grabbing a basketball rebound and then land again. And while that's very controlled and it's a very robust biomechanical model and we know what, you know, kind of normal landing mechanics should be, it's really not stressing the athlete in any way. And it's not providing any kind of context for these movements, either in a competitive environment or kind of in an unanticipated context where, you know I need to land and jump, but I'm not sure when and where I have to do that. I'm not sure what this opponent is going to do as I leave my feet. Am I going to have to alter my trunk position to avoid colliding with that athlete and so on and so forth? And so by putting them in these virtual scenarios where we can control the flight of the ball, we can control the defender, we can control the goalie position, we can control the height of the ball, the speed of the ball, all of these things, while still kind of leading them into an area where they'll perform a very similar maneuver to that drop vertical jump is really pretty exciting. And I think the athletes tend to be more motivated while they're performing it too, because it is a little bit of a competition for them.
Do you offer any feedback in the sense of like force feedback or haptic feedback or just tactile feedback when they catch the ball or when they interact with the ball?
So we haven't yet. We're still doing the pilot data collections, but our goal is by January at the earliest or by next June, about a year from now, that we will be utilizing some haptic feedback either on the head or on the shoulders. Just giving them some form of feedback so that they would know that they did successfully have the ball. The way we're dealing with that right now, and it's kind of a shortcut, is that based on the colliders that my programmers have set up in the virtual environment, if the head is anywhere close to that collision boundary with the ball, we just make the ball go straight ahead into the goal, regardless of where it would have actually hit the head. So they at least get some visual feedback that they were successful. So that we can start to get them used to performing this in kind of a successful way.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see the uses of virtual reality maybe after you develop your very amazing setup further? Like, what could you imagine could be also researched in your area of interest?
Well, I think actually the when I said this was low-hanging fruit, I think the really cool, innovative, and potentially most impactful applications of VR and this technology is going to be in both training and rehabilitation, because you can alter, you know, the virtual world and the virtual space in ways that you could never do in the real world. So I can give healthy athletes limitations in the virtual world that they have to overcome. I can provide sport contexts, or they don't even have to be realistic contexts, that force the athlete to make fast decisions, move in unexpected ways, and I can alter these things in ways that are almost imperceivable to the athlete. You know, I can teleport them all of a sudden and now they're somewhere where they didn't expect to be, or I can, you know, change the gains with how fast they're moving in the real world relative to how fast they're actually moving in the virtual world, and work on slowing down movements where they are slowed down kind of subconsciously.
So essentially introducing more desirable difficulties, but in more controlled ways.
Exactly. And then we're not even scratching the surface of adding a second user into that environment. So our current system, I mean, the nice thing about the Nereus is that you can have two of them going and they don't seem to interfere with each other. I haven't gone past two. But as long as in our system, if we have two PCs, which we currently have, and we have kind of two hubs running our virtual environments, we can put two users in. They can share the virtual space without sharing the physical space, or they can share both the virtual and physical space, depending on what the training application is. And we can do all sorts of things. I can change how the user one is perceiving the movements of user two by changing what those movements look like to user one. I can make the environment easier for one user and harder for the other. So there's lots of ways that I can do that. I can simulate injuries based on the information that I'm providing one of them over the other. And I can see how their coordination between the two, which you can imagine in team sports, looking at how team coordination plays out is really important. So I don't even think we're scratching the surface on the power of this technology. And that's kind of what we're trying to do, is we're looking at some of the logistics of what we're collecting right now with these sport-specific scenarios. And then we're really going to try to push the envelope in the coming years with developing some very interesting, interactive, complex training and rehabilitation scenarios.
A quick question. Is the motion tracking system that you're using running calculations on the CPU or the GPU?
It is running them on the CPU, and it's on a separate computer. So we connect the other computer to the Unity computer via an Ethernet cable. And that is only so that it's kind of a way to cheat for us, because generally it's more expensive, of course, to buy two computers versus one. But then we don't have to play with any latency issues.
Exactly.
I don't know that we would have any latency issues, but I just wanted to be sure that we didn't have to deal with those. Now, the other limitation, at least with motion analysis software, is that their motion capture window, which is in their software, which is called Cortex, has to be running in the foreground at all times. So you can imagine if you're splitting the display, that can be a huge pain. So we just, again, they're still kind of developing plugins and things. So until they get to where we need them to be, we just decided it's safest just to run on two different PCs.
Is there maybe a reason why you chose against Xsense? Because I've been actually talking with those guys. Those are IMUs you place on your body, because I was on the Unite in Amsterdam from Unity, and they were also there showing off their technology with Manus VR together. And what they promise, even though they are very costly, like $20,000, I think, is one setup from them, that they have proper filters for some kind of magnetic distortion and so on. So in theory, at least from what the guy from Manus VR was, from Xsense was telling me, you could track how a person is running in a room without cameras.
Yeah, we have looked at some IMUs. And in fact, so I used to do some consulting for Qualysys motion capture. And I know at one point, I think they may have even developed a IMU embedded reflective marker, so that if you had marker dropout, the IMU would kind of take over.
How was it called again? That they have this technology, the company you've been doing work for?
Qualysys. They're out of Sweden. And they are doing some really interesting development. They were kind of playing catch up in the VR space initially. They were doing some really interesting things. The one issue with IMUs, though, and you guys probably know this, is that if you're not moving, it kind of just stops tracking, because it kind of hits a zero point. And so that's the one hesitation I've always had with going to a completely IMU-driven motion system.
Yeah, I understand. But if we think about what you in your everyday life as a scientist and also we need, do you see that there is still a huge lack of, let's say, proper hardware and software when we think about those problems, like the software has to be all the time in the foreground, and then you have to build your own HMD and other things. Like, is there like still not the proper hardware and software out there that we as a scientist can do our science properly? Do you perceive it that way?
Yes, definitely. And a lot of it's a money issue, of course.
Okay.
But I do think that was kind of what motivated us to do it on our end, is we just weren't happy with what was out there. And granted, we're using a very expensive motion capture system to drive a lot of what we're doing, but that's only because we need the high fidelity biomechanics for our actual data. If we were just interested in running VR, and if I just wanted to track the head, for instance, I could use much cheaper technologies and get away with that. So I think it all comes down to the data that you're interested in looking at and collecting, and the types of experiments that you're running. I certainly think you can get away with more inexpensive tracking technologies. Now, the head-mounted display, if you want to be wireless, there are a lot of limitations. And, you know, I have seen a couple of them that have been up saying, you know, I think the one that you guys mentioned earlier, what was the name of it? It was just on...
the tracking?
Yeah, it was just... No, I'm sorry, the wireless solution...
Or Nitero.
Yeah. I see them. I was actually just reading about them this week, and I see they're making some claims about they're going to be ready by, you know, late 2016. And I'm very anxious to see if they can pull that off, because I would love to get out of the hardware business and spend more time in the research business.
Absolutely.
And I think a lot of researchers would agree with that. But until something happens, you know, it's just going to be the nature of our position.
Adam, bringing this back to humans and people and experience, how have the athletes that you've been working with been dealing with virtual reality? I mean, how have they been kind of responding to this new technology? And do you think they've been feeling the benefit or understanding the dream behind it?
I think they, well, I can say they love it. They are really having a lot of fun. So the ages that we're looking at right now are 14 to 18 year old girls, because we're doing a high school soccer study.
Nice.
And we've brought them in, and even though, you know, that generation is really tech savvy, I think about 90-95% of them have never been in virtual reality. A lot of them haven't even heard of the Oculus yet, which always is kind of reminds me of where we actually are in this space. You know, when you live in the VR space and you know all of these things, you kind of think about how popular all these things must be. But then when I'm dealing with young kids who aren't that familiar with these devices, it kind of brings you back to reality a little bit. But that's kind of an aside. So anyway, when they come in, a lot of them are a little bit, I kind of say it's like they're newborn deer, where they're kind of really cautious as they're walking, as we're putting them in the acclimation environment. And the way we've set it up is we kind of increase the intensity over about a 5 to 7 minute period. So they're in the soccer stadium, and we're giving them audio instructions, again, wirelessly through the HMD and the headphones. And we start by having them walk to a target that's, you know, again, about, you know, 12, 15 meters away. And then once they get there, then the instructions are, now jog back to where you came from. And they jog back to where they came from. And then the next instructions are to sprint back to where they came from in the last time. And by the time we ask them to sprint, most of them are up, I would say, probably to 80% of their maximum sprint, and are kind of getting into it. The way we've combated the vision of the space in virtual reality versus the physical walls is that we've put virtual cones up, and we basically tell them through those audio instructions, as long as they stay within the cones, they're within a open, safe space in the environment. And then if they were to go outside of the cones, a virtual kind of red police tape comes up. We have a loud kind of buzzer that sounds, and we also have a research assistant who's kind of knows where they're supposed to be running to. So he's setting up, making sure he can catch them well before they hit any walls. And we give them about a 6-foot cushion between any walls before any of that stuff would happen.
Did anyone manage run against the wall?
No, we haven't had anybody run into anything. We've had no close calls so far. And again, that's the nice thing about VR, is we can control where we want them to move. And they don't really realize that we're leading them into certain areas of the lab. But we kind of keep them in the center of the space as much as possible, or at least that's where the dynamic movements are all occurring.
How often do you need to repeat the instruction to people? Because I am asking because
often in consumer VR content, people don't listen to the narration instruction. They don't look at the instruction given in the game. They just do things. So do you also came across that problem?
Oh, we have a little bit. What I've learned from my years in the Venn Lab and then starting to pilot this work is that we kind of hit them over the head with the instructions as often as we can in that acclimation time. And we get them mm-hmm. used to the same type of symbols, the same location indicators, the same auditory feedback. So we have whistles that start every task and stop every task. And that remains consistent across all of our scenarios. From the minute they're in VR, we have a systematic environment that's providing the same type of feedback for what we want them to do. And then we repeat the instructions probably 3 or 4 times about how we want them to move. And then once they get into the actual experimental scenarios, we usually do 2 or 3 practice trials of what we want them to do. So by the time we have actual data collection trials starting, they're exhausted with the instructions and they know exactly mm-hmm. what they need to do.
Adam, now that you're talking about kind of motion capture, I think one of the biggest things I'm excited about, especially for augmented reality, is training. Because, right, YouTube isn't just for sharing videos, but you learn a lot through YouTube by watching people do things, right? Monkey see, monkey do. What I think is going to be huge for immersive tech is the ability to actually see a person in front of you kind of doing a motion and you mimicking them, either mirroring them or actually stepping into their own body, as in like walking into that hologram and then kind of trying to go into the same pose. Have you guys experimented with anything along those lines? Especially, I mean, if you're already getting their body tracked, can you maybe put them as a ghost as well and then have them step out of their own body and look at the motion that they just did and point out the, you know, correct limb or what the incorrect limb that they need to fix in their pose?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question, because that was a large discussion and lengthy discussion that I had with several of my colleagues as we were looking at how to train ACL, which is anterior cruciate ligament injury prevention, so knee injury prevention in these athletes. And we wanted to use real-time feedback or use an expert model that they could mimic to build up these kind of robust biomechanical movement patterns that we want our athletes to have as they go out on the playing field. And what a lot of the research has shown, and it's not been done by us, but there's been a lot of people who have been looking at motor learning and motor feedback problems over the last 10, 15, 20 years, they show that actually external feedback, so not necessarily joint-specific feedback, but more kind of global movement patterns, are more useful mm-hmm. for learning and retention. And also, they are showing that more abstract feedback can oftentimes be more beneficial, because the visual system, if you train the visual system to a certain stimulus, you will actually have the opportunity to override some of the motor coordination deficiencies that the individual might have. So
that's quite powerful, right?
It's very powerful.
If you can really change the behavior of a person, right?
Absolutely. In fact, my colleague says that vision is kind of the Ethernet of feedback and that sort of thing. Because it just allows so much information to come in so quickly. And we are so attuned to it. I mean, from the moment we're born, we are taking in visual information. I mean, we're taking in all of the information, but we really rely heavily on vision to do a lot of the motor tasks and all tasks that we do. So what we decided was, instead of going through kind of a human mimicry type feedback, we were just going to go completely abstract. And so we had about 6 variables that we knew were predictive of ACL injury in female athletes. And they all were able to be evaluated when they did certain maneuvers like the drop vertical jump, or in our case, we were looking at kind of just body weight squatting maneuvers. So if you're doing a normal squat, mm-hmm. but just with no weight. And what we did is we put those 6 variables into a stimulus display that was just a rectangle. And we didn't tell them, make sure that you don't have asymmetries between your ground reaction force at your feet, or make sure you don't have, you know, your knee isn't collapsing inward, which is a predictor of ACL injury risk. Instead, we said just make a rectangle. And as long as that shape is a perfect rectangle as you're squatting, your biomechanics are exactly where they need to be. And if it's not a rectangle, try to learn how to control it with your body movements until you make it a rectangle.
That's very impressive.
That's great. Yeah.
And I mean, when we think about the second topic we wanted to discuss today, is what science can do for VR. What you just described is a very intuitive and amazing way how you could enforce teaching, to teach someone to a person and him be learning it through this, you know, very abstract way of representing it. When we would kind of, you know, start thinking about what can we as scientists start to research to help out the developers who are there doing maybe also games in VR, but also serious experiences. I mean, they all face the same problems as we do. Yes, their experience have to be more fancy, but you still have kind of to teach your, you know, gamer how to behave in a certain environment. It's kind of similar. So where would you see the big topics that research need to move towards actually researching to help the whole VR community and the second wave of VR moving forward? I mean, there are some obvious things as motion sickness, but maybe there are less obvious things you could think of.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's interesting you bring up motion sickness is, we always had motion sickness problems when the users were not controlling their movements and when they were kind of tethered to a computer. The minute we let people kind of be free and have wireless movements in our virtual space, just like you would in the real world, we have not run into, I don't think we've had any motion sickness at this point. And I think that says a lot about where VR needs to go to kind of combat some of that. Now, there are the few, in fact, one of our research assistants, he just has some inherent motion sickness to a lot of different situations. And he was able to last about 15 minutes before it really started to get to the point where he was getting uncomfortable. But I still think that's kind of impressive in a way that he was still able to get into this free ambulatory virtual environment. And he was able to do it without feeling nauseous for, you know, 10 to 15 minutes. So I do think that's an area, but I think it might fix itself a little bit with our move away from cables as technology advances. I really think, at least for me, the area that I'm interested in seeing what happens is this area where we try to move away from realism and simulating the world as we know it and actually get into some really abstract environments that we've never really experienced and learn how our systems adapt. Because I think there's new ways that we can provide instructions for learning, you know, how to play a certain game. There's ways that we can train motor patterns that we've never even looked at before because we've never had the technology to do that. I think that's where the power of this all lies, and I think that's the most interesting research for me at this point.
What's your stance towards it, Chris?
I just thought about creating, instead of Flatland, maybe you had heard about the concept. It's a world without a third dimension, to create a VR land that is removing the realism but substituting it with something that we cannot do in the real world. And then there is the whole VR land concept created.
But you're also a big fan of UI and UX research. Do you think that when we start to understand better how and in what terms you should design the UI and UX experience of VR, we can, you know, kind of push forward the overall quality of experience?
Definitely. The one trick here to consider is that most of the successful user interfaces were created just by having a concept, making prototype, releasing it, and then seeing what happens. So I'm a big fan of doing first some research on the specific topic and then seeing how people react to it and actually quantify it and measure and compare it to previous solutions. But since virtual reality right now is created for consumers or mostly for consumers, sadly, we need to develop faster than through research.
And what's your stance towards it, Azad?
I think the rectangle box idea is beautiful and really intuitive in the sense that it is a really primitive form of biofeedback. That's not even EEG or EOG based. It's all just, you know, IMU. But in the end, it kind of is an abstract representation of what you're doing and what you need to be doing. And in the end, that's really what's going to be driving this medium forward. So I'm really glad you mentioned that, Adam. And I think what you guys are doing is utterly inspirational. Do you guys do any kind of demos for outsiders? I mean, I haven't been in a wireless system like that in terms of such a huge scale.
Well, thank you first for the compliment. We're really excited about that approach as well. We do demos if people want to come to Cincinnati, I guess, is the short answer. We are working on trying to get some of our work out there. So I have a really awesome team here, and I want to make sure I do mention. So the University of Cincinnati has a group that's UC Simulation and Virtual Environments, headed up by a woman named Chris Collins, and they do all of our VR development. And I was just talking with her yesterday, actually, about maybe going to some conferences, maybe like IEEE and those sorts of more technical conferences, mm-hmm. more engineering conferences with our device, and just showing, you know, what's possible, what we've been able to pull off, so that either A, maybe some people want to utilize our device, or B, maybe we can inspire some other people who are much more technologically advanced than I am and on the hardware side to actually, you know, take this even further. Into devices that are going to really benefit the research community.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the last point we should quickly address is, what do you think will be the products based on science and VRs that will actually help people? I mean, there are, again, very obvious things like anxiety treatment and stuff, but apparently you can also help athletes with VR, right? So after you've done your research and this becomes more and more facilitated, it can be also a product, right?
Absolutely. And I could see us moving that way eventually. I mean, as you probably know, hardware is kind of cheap and it's hard to make a lot of money on hardware. So I think the content is really key. And, and that's really where we're turning our focus. Now that we have our hardware platform, at least down to a usable form, we are moving completely into how can we create these virtual environments in ways like we've been talking about that can really create efficient training outcomes for these athletes, both the athletes who were trying to prevent from having an initial injury and those athletes coming back from serious injury. One of the biggest benefits, I think, at least in the physical therapy and rehabilitation space, is actually creating really simple environments for people as they're returning from injury that we can slowly ramp up complexity in, so that as they're physically healing, they're also kind of learning or relearning how to control their movements with either the newfound limitation that they may have, because it usually takes, even though they're returning to play, they're oftentimes not fully healthy. And there's a lot of research that's supporting that. So I think it's kind of just like bringing a child along is kind of the analogy that I would make. You're teaching a child to walk. There's definitely steps the child has to take before, no pun intended, there's steps that the child has to take before it can actually take real steps. And that's kind of what we want to do in virtual reality. So I think that's one area or market that I think is open. And the reason for that is because a physical therapy clinic can afford a more expensive system. You know, we saw that outcry of people when the Oculus consumer version came out, and it was a little bit higher than people had anticipated.
But it's so cheap for us, for scientists and for like industrial users. Such a low, nice price. Come on.
No, it is. And but a physical therapy clinic, you know, they're used to paying $10,000 for a training device. So if I can package a training device and, you know, we use different kind of motion sensors that are cheaper and things like that, and I can come in at $10,000 or $15,000 with everything, now that's a price point because they can use it to help their patients, and they can likely bill for it through insurance. So now they have a revenue stream that's supporting that market, which is important when you're looking at these products.
I totally agree with you there. We are also building this chronic pain management in the company we're working on with Chris. And it's like also the idea, you just give it to patients, some kind of ready VR setup, and they train at home to manage better the chronic pains. And the price compared to what you used to pay for VR devices is like incredibly low. So I totally agree with you there. It's like amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you hit it right on the head, having them also be able to take something home and be able to train and have likely you know, sending that data into the cloud for the physician or the clinician to be able to track their training is also hugely important.
Exactly. It's like super amazing to see your doctor, you know, checking from time to time your success and motivating you. Telemedicine is also helping people who are far away from the doctor, right? It's not only...
Forget the doctor. I mean, once now that we have Watson and also... I believe the Google DeepMind now is kind of going into health as well. You have, you know, automatic kind of feedback that you're getting back from your AI diagnostician that's telling you how you're doing and what you're doing. The more sensors we have, the more processing, the more machine learning we have, the better our data gets.
Fun fact, there was just a study released where they tried to understand, I think it was the first Apple computer chip with brain science methods, and they failed. So the idea was, you know, if we, you know, have enough data, we have the best methods to understand the brain, you know, we should be able to actually do it also with a computer chip. Well, obviously those methods are not very easily applicable, but sometimes less is more, and having the right approach can help you out more than having just more and more and more and more data. But that's true. Now, Adam, do you have any other comments regards anything? Maybe someone who is listening to us would like to, you know, hear from you. Would you like to say anything to our audience?
Just that I think this is a really promising area. I think it's going to be really beneficial for us in research and scientific fields as we move forward. I do think there's probably a unintentional conflict of interest at times between the researchers and kind of these consumer grade VR companies. Some of it may not matter, again, depending on what we're looking at scientifically. But I do think as researchers, you know, now is the time for us to kind of start to dictate a little bit about what we need, especially at these low cost levels, and to be proactive about it. I think it's so easy now to go get a 3D printer and print out these plans that are already there. I mean, 3D printers are coming down in price. Phone screens are really inexpensive, so hardware costs are coming way down. I think, you know, we're producing, not counting the wireless transmitter receiver, which is pricey, our HMD itself, I think, was even coming in under the OSVR price if we were looking at just the cost of the components. So I think the time is now for us as a group to kind of come together and look at some of these solutions and how we can kind of advance things for science.
Yeah. And I would love to see more initiatives like NVIDIA had a year ago or so. I'm not sure if it's still active, but we got at our university a Titan X from NVIDIA for free for our research. We just had to supply them a proposal, three pages, and they send it to us. So I would like to see more initiative like this, since Oculus or Vive don't earn too much on the single device.
They don't respond to our emails. Like, there is basically no way as a researcher to contact those bigger companies and talk with them reasonably. Even from the industry where we are coming from right now, it's very hard to talk to them. They're only really interested in game publishers. So it's a tough game, and maybe, you know, building your own hardware is the right answer, and, you know, just screw them.
I agree with you guys, and I think it would be really nice to set up some, you know, some partnerships, whether it's licensing partnerships with some of these companies so that we can get more cost-effective parts, or if it's just a straight partnership where you are sending in an application and they're either providing some hardware or even some, you know, minimal funds. Some of these companies have a lot of money that they're throwing at development, and they could easily outsource some of that for pretty low costs to researchers like all of us and those listening to be able to do some pretty innovative things.
Definitely. So, Palmer Lucky, as you're listening to our podcast, you just heard what you have to do.
We are first on the list.
thank you, Adam, for giving us such a breadth of knowledge of what's happening on the sports side of VR research. And I think this is applicable to almost everyone, because we all sit at our computers, but we do step up every once in a while and like to go on a walk outside. And knowing how not to injure ourselves is probably a good thing. How can listeners follow you? How can they contact you, and how can they find out more about you and your research?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. It's been really great. I really appreciate what you guys are doing for VR and research. I think this podcast is a great addition to my podcast list for sure. But yeah, you can follow me on Twitter actually at @awkiefer. I'm also you can find me at Cincinnati Children's website if you just search my name, and my email address and web bio and everything will come up there. But Twitter is probably the best way to get in contact with me. I'm always interested in talking with new people, coming up with new ideas, and even partnering with individuals or companies. We're always looking to keep pushing the technology and being at the front end of all of this development because it's very exciting. Ultimately,
that's how you contacted us, right? Through Twitter.
Exactly. Yeah, we connected through Twitter, and and now here we are.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, we want to thank everyone for listening again today. Keep tuned for new episodes with interviews with the most interesting research-based companies. You can follow us on Twitter at ResearchVRCast. You can email us at researchvrcast@gmail.com. And you can find us on Facebook if you search ResearchVR. If you don't want to listen to this just on your phone or through whatever podcasting client you're using, you can also listen to it in your browser on SoundCloud. Thanks everyone for joining in, and follow us next time.